From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The weekend APEC summit in Port Moresby ended in some disarray. For the first time in APEC's history, we don't have a leaders' communique. The meeting and the developments around it have simply highlighted the increasing tensions between the United States and China, which have enormous implications for Australia. The Morrison government recently announced a pivot in policy towards the Pacific. Now Australia and the US will partner with PNG in the redevelopment of a naval base on Manus Island. Although the Australian government doesn't want to admit it, all this is driven by concern about China. Jonathan Pryke is from the Lowy Institute and he was watching the summit through the weekend. He joined us from Port Moresby. Jonathan Pryke, APEC summits are typically quite benign, sometimes quite dull. This one, in contrast, seems to have been distinctly combative for the tone of some leaders, most notably US Vice President Mike Pence. Why was this summit different?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess it just is a reflection of how tensions have really been boiling up over the last 12 months with trade, really, which has often been the ballast in the relationship between China and the US, and indeed China and Australia. Trade now becoming the front line for growing geopolitical tensions. So, yeah, APEC is, as you say, is usually pretty benign, pretty boring. I mean, indeed, it's most famous for the silly shirts that leaders find themselves wearing at the end of them. But, you know, the fact that we don't have a communique coming out of this summit is really significant.
Do you think the summit's left American-China relations significantly worse off?
Well, it's certainly quite distressing for all parties that they weren't able to find common ground. There is a fear that, you know, we're losing the middle here, that we're walking into a sort of zero-sum game approach in the Asia-Pacific where countries like Australia see that there's less options to be able to stay in the middle. We might be having to pick sides. And the combative nature between these two giants in the region is really quite worrying.
This talk of Australia walking the middle, not having to choose, which we have heard from our leaders for years, but it's really false, isn't it? Because when it came to the point, when it comes to the point, we choose America.
Well, yeah, I mean, it really, the economic relationship, of course, with China is our most important one. But we have, through our foreign policy white paper, made it very clear that we want to stay linked with the United States, who are our security insurer in many ways. We see, whilst there is this decoupling between China and the United States, you know, the desire for a convergence of China into the international liberal order seems like a bit of a fantasy now. We are still committed to maintaining the international liberal order that America has championed for many decades, despite the rhetoric we're hearing from the Trump administration wanting to walk away from parts of that order. We still want to see it maintained, and I think a lot of other middle countries like Australia also want to see it maintained. So whilst the summit, you know, has left everyone on a pretty sour note because of the state of the communique, I think it's still important for all the middle powers to find more ways in which they can communicate together and work together to maintain this liberal order.
Where do you see the US-China trade war going from here? Scott Morrison seemed to be quite optimistic that it would subside. He seems to be looking to the G20, which is coming up in a week or two, to pick up some of those issues. Is this realistic?
Well, yeah. I mean, the language coming out of Mike Pence was the most forthright we've heard, you know, talking about how the belt could strangle you and the road leads nowhere. I mean, whilst it's all colourful language, it also sent a pretty disturbing message to China. And so hopefully the strategy here is that Pence is coming in as the attack dog and is really laying down the gauntlet and leaving the room for Trump to then to show up at the G20 to you know, make a deal, to find the middle ground that that at the moment doesn't seem to be possible. So hopefully that's what we're going to see. We're going to see Trump really back down from this rhetoric. But, you know, Trump's a wild card. It could go any direction, really. Who knows what Fox News says on any given day or what mood he's in. And so, you know, it's in everyone's interest that we do see the temperature ratchet down and that they do find some compromise on this trade language. But, you know, the stakes are certainly high for the G20.
Just turning to the redevelopment of the Manus Naval Base that Australia's involved in, how significant do you see this as being?
Yeah, so the devil's really going to be in the deep here because we don't really have much information at all as to the size and scope of this facility that the US, Australia and Papua New Guinea will be partnering on. The Manus Island is geostrategically important, and the Ankhens support that they are talking about had great significance in World War II, where they had 37,000 personnel stationed there, 200 anchorage for 260 ships, and repair facilities that rivaled Pearl Harbor. So, you know, there is scope for it to be a significant facility at this port, but there's also scope for it to be a patrol boat with, a deployment of 10 people. So, how committed will be in the US is in engaging this far south of in the Pacific will be in the detail. But it does send a strong symbolic and message to China that they have strategic ambitions for the Pacific, but it's in Australia and US's interest to keep them out.
And what do you think the implications will be of Australia's participation in the development of this base and also our pivot towards the Pacific for our general relationship with China, which was bad and now has been improving a bit in recent times?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And in recent weeks, since Minister Payne's visit to Beijing, we've seen a more conciliatory tone come out from China. And indeed, that's also linked to the Pacific, where they've recently said that they're interested in doing more in partnership with Australia in the Pacific Islands region. And, I mean, all of that's very welcome for Australia. But Australia's also made it very clear to China that whilst we welcome their engagement in the Pacific in diplomacy and in aid, in infrastructure, where we don't welcome their engagement is in the strategic space. If China has strategic ambitions of setting up some sort of permanent military facility in the Pacific, that is not at all aligned with Australia's national interest. And we've made that quite clear. And we're making that clear through the announcement of the military base. So I think it's making it clear where we stand on these issues. I think shouldn't affect the state of the relationship, but it really depends on how set China is on their ambitions of setting up, of engaging strategically in the Pacific.
Australian ministers are very anxious to say all this doesn't have anything to do with China. That's their line publicly. Is this really just a necessary line for diplomacy, or is it so unbelievable that we'd be better to be a little bit more open about things?
Yeah, look, the Pacific is a unique part of the world and a unique relationship for Australia. We have very strong interest in the Pacific. It is very strategically important for us. It is also important because it is our immediate neighbourhood and we have very strong aid, trade, investment, migration ties with the region. And so, you know, there's always a lot of focus within various parts of the bureaucracy on the Pacific, but that hasn't been mirrored with public interest and indeed political interest. And I think China has driven the public and political interest back to the Pacific and has created a sense of urgency that we often don't see in the Pacific region. And so I think that's all quite welcome because we are seeing the government actually step up its game and re-engage with the region in a significant way. And, yeah, I think it's fine to be frank about what's driving that, and that is China.
Do you think, though, we have been really neglectful in our foreign policy, leaving this pivot to the Pacific far too late?
I wouldn't say it's too late. I think it's better, always better late than never. It is welcome, and I think, there has been some groundwork laid here. The foreign policy white paper did devote a whole chapter to our unique relationship with the Pacific and laying a good framework for how we should be re-engaging. But unfortunately, the political push behind it didn't lead to much in the announcement space. But we've seen that now with Scott Morrison, the major announcements of more funding for infrastructure, more funding to get Australian businesses into the region, more diplomatic posts to the Pacific. We are really putting our money where our mouths are now, and it's all welcome. I think it is being welcomed in the region. So, no, I wouldn't characterise it as too late.
Is this all good for the region, or is there a real danger, some warning of the countries getting into too much debt?
Yeah, so the debt question is a good one, and the reality is that many Pacific Island countries are already at their debt threshold. So the debt space in the Pacific is already quite a congested one. You have China, but you also have the Asian Development Bank, the World Bank, both upping their game in the Pacific, and then also just commercial lending. And the reality is many of these Pacific countries are small. They have limited windows for taking on debt. and most of them have reached their limits. And they're all conscious of this. They're not behaving badly here. No Pacific Island country since 2016, except for Papua New Guinea, has taken the new loan from China since 2016. They are all conscious of where their debt levels stand. So if Australia is going to now barge into the debt space in the Pacific and offer a whole lot more debt for infrastructure, I think it's going to be a hard sell for many of these Pacific Island countries. But, you know, it's great to have options. And if we package our new commitments in the right way, I think it can definitely be beneficial for the Pacific. So if this greater geostrategic game and the enhanced geopolitical interest on the Pacific just brings more attention, brings more aid to the region, I think it's a good thing.
Coming back to APEC specifically, was it worthwhile for Papua New Guinea to host this meeting? There was criticism of the big cost, but on the other hand, PNG's been the beneficiary of various announcements, including Australia and other countries combining to upgrade much-needed electricity facilities. So on balance, was it good or bad for PNG?
Yeah, I think it's still too soon to tell. I think PNG has been situated in the right place, right time for hosting the APEC summit. So I think overall, it's still too soon to tell. It was a big gamble for the PNG government to host APEC. And, you know, there's a long history. Just 5 years ago, when they committed to hosting APEC, the economic fortunes of the country were looking far different than they are today. They had double-digit growth. They were expecting to have double-digit growth for the next 5 years, and this is going to be a real coming-out party for Papua New Guinea. This last 5 years haven't turned out that way. The country is mired in an economic crisis at the moment, and so which made the cost of this and indeed the opportunity cost of it far higher. But it could still be worth it because it has indeed brought more attention to PNG. It has put PNG in the spotlight like it never has been before. There will be renewed investment interest from the private sector. And on the A front, they've already struck gold with this massive infrastructure project committed by the West. So, you know, I think we're off to a good start for this being, in the end, a success for PNG. And they pulled it off. You know, this is something they've never done anything close to the magnitude of hosting this leaders' summit before, and it all went relatively smoothly.
Now, just finally, in recent years, there's been a feeling that the summit season's overloaded and that perhaps APEC has worn out its usefulness. Do you think it still serves a productive purpose, or has it lost the economic focus it started with just to become a discussion point of whatever issues are on the general international horizon?
Well, it's certainly becoming harder for APEC to remain relevant as the big countries are turning more protectionist. This is ultimately about integrating the APEC economies and enhancing trade liberalisation. And when you don't have the big countries signing up to that agenda, it makes it hard. But I think APEC is still important because it doesn't just bring together the two world leaders, it brings together all the other leaders of Asia. And so all the bilateral meetings that take place, all the opportunities to actually build relationships between leaders, I think that's all really still really important. And, you know, I think there are a few other summits that could probably go the way of the dinosaur before APEC. But it's certainly the fact that we couldn't get a communique out of this week, I think, sends a pretty worrying message and just reinforces that countries like Australia, who are in the middle, we need to be working harder to try and find, maintain and build the middle ground.
Jonathan Pryke, thank you very much for talking with The Conversation today. That's all from this podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.